Chapter 58. I come to an end of my battles and bruises. That feverish desire to gain a little reputation which Esmond had had, left him now perhaps, that he had attained some portion of his wish, and the great motive of his ambition was over. His desire for military honor was that it might raise him in Beatrix's eyes. 'Twas next to nobility and wealth, the only kind of rank she valued. It was the state quickest won or lost to, for law is a very long game, that requires a life to practice, and to be distinguished in letters, or the church would not have forwarded the poor gentleman's plans in the least. So he had no suit to play, but the red one, and he played it, and this, in truth, was the reason of his speedy promotion, for he exposed himself more than most gentlemen do, and risked more to win more. Is he the only man that hath set his life against a state which may be not worth the winning? Another risks his life and his honor too, sometimes, against a bundle of banknotes, or a yard of blue ribbon, or a seat in Parliament, and some for the mere pleasure and excitement of the sport, as a field of 100 huntsmen will do, each out bawling and out galloping the other at the tail of a dirty fox, that is to be the prize of the foremost happy conqueror. When he heard this news of Beatrix's engagement in marriage, Colonel Esmond knocked under to his fate, and resolved to surrender his sword, that could win him nothing now he cared for, and in this dismal frame of mind he determined to retire from the regiment, to the great delight of the captain next in rank to him, who happened to be a young gentleman of good fortune, who eagerly paid Mr. Esmond 1,000 guineas for his majority in Webb's regiment, and was knocked on the head the next campaign. Perhaps Esmond would not have been sorry to share his fate. He was more the knight of the woeful countenance than ever he had been. His moodiness must have made him perfectly odious to his friends under the tents, who like a jolly fellow, and laugh at a melancholy warrior always sighing after Dulcinea at home. Both the ladies of Castlewood approved of Mr. Esmond quitting the army, and his kind general coincided in his wish of retirement, and helped in the transfer of his commission, which brought a pretty sum into his pocket. But when the commander-in-chief came home, and was forced, in spite of himself, to appoint Lieutenant General Webb to the command of a division of the army in Flanders, the Lieutenant General prayed Colonel Esmond so urgently to be his aide-de-camp and military secretary, that Esmond could not resist his kind patron's entreaties, and again took the field, not attached to any regiment, but under Webb's orders. What must have been the continued agonies of fears asterisk and apprehensions which racked the gentle breasts of wives and matrons in those dreadful days, when every gazette brought accounts of deaths and battles, and when the present anxiety over, and the beloved person escaped, the doubt still remained, that a battle might be fought, possibly, of which the next Flanders letter would bring the account. So they, the poor tender creatures, had to go on sickening and trembling through the whole campaign. Whatever these terrors were on the part of Esmond's mistress, and that tenderest of women must have felt them most keenly for both her sons, as she called them, she never allowed them outwardly to appear, but hid her apprehension, as she did her charities and devotion. 'Twas only by chance that Esmond, wandering in Kensington, found his mistress coming out of a mean cottage there, and heard that as he had a score of poor retainers, whom she visited and comforted in their sickness and poverty, and who blessed her daily. She attended the early church daily, though of a Sunday, especially, she encouraged and advanced all sorts of cheerfulness, and innocent gaiety in her little household, and by notes entered into a table book of hers at this time, and devotional compositions writ with a sweet artless fervor, such as the best divines could not surpass, showed how fond her heart was, how humble and pious her spirit, what pangs of apprehension she endured silently, and with what a faithful reliance she committed the care of those she loved to the awful dispenser of death and life. Asterisk what indeed? PSM. Psi. 237. R. E, as for her ladyship of Chelsea, Esmond's newly adopted mother, she was now of an age, when the danger of any second party doth not disturb the rest much. She cared for trumps more than for most things in life. She was firm enough in her own faith, but no longer very bitter against ours. S. He had a very good-natured, easy French director, Monsieur Gauthier by name, who was a gentleman of the world, and would take a hand of cards with Dean Atterbury, my lady's neighbor at Chelsea, and was well with all the high church party. No doubt Monsieur Gauthier knew what Esmond's peculiar position was, for he corresponded with Holt, and always treated Colonel Esmond with particular respect and kindness. But for good reasons the Colonel and the Abbe never spoke on this matter together, and so they remained perfect good friends. All the frequenters of my lady of Chelsea's house were of the Tory and High Church party. Madame Beatrix was as frantic about the king as her elderly kinswoman. She wore his picture on her heart, as he had a piece of his hair. She vowed he was the most injured, and gallant, and accomplished, and unfortunate, and beautiful of princes. Steele, who quarreled with very many of his Tory friends, but never with Esmond, used to tell the colonel that his kinswoman's house was a rendezvous of Tory intrigues, that Gauthier was a spy, that Atterbury was a spy, that letters were constantly going from that house to the Queen at St. Germain's, on which Esmond, laughing, would reply that they used to say in the army the Duke of Marlborough was a spy too, and as much in correspondence with that family as any Jesuit. And without entering very eagerly into the controversy, Esmond had frankly taken the side of his family. It seemed to him that King James III was undoubtedly King of England by right, and at his sister's death it would be better to have him than a foreigner over us. No man admired King William more, a hero and a conqueror, the bravest, justest, wisest of men, but was by the sword he conquered the country, and held and governed it by the very same right that the great Cromwell held it, who was truly and greatly a sovereign. But that a foreign despotic prince, out of Germany, who happened to be descended from King James I, should take possession of this empire, seemed to Mr. Esmond a monstrous injustice at least. Every Englishman had a right to protest, and the English prince, the heir at law, the first of all. What man of spirit with such a cause would not back it? What man of honor with such a crown to win, would not fight for it? But that race was destined. That prince had himself against him, an enemy he could not overcome. He never dared to draw his sword, though he had it. He let his chances slip by as he lay in the lap of opera girls, or sniveled at the knees of priests asking pardon, and the blood of heroes, and the devotedness of honest hearts, and endurance, courage, fidelity, were all spent for him in vain. But let us return to my lady of Chelsea, who, when her son Esmond announced to her ladyship that he proposed to make the ensuing campaign, took leave of him with perfect alacrity, and was down to picket with her gentlewoman, before he had well quitted the room on his last visit. "Here's to a king," were the last words he ever heard her say. The game of life was pretty nearly over for the good lady, and 3 months afterwards she took to her bed, where she flickered out without any pain. So the Abbe Gauthier rode over to Mr. Esmond, then with his general on the frontier of France. The Lady Castlewood was with her at her ending, and had written to, but these letters must have been taken by a privateer in the packet that brought them, for Esmond knew nothing of their contents until his return to England. My Lady Castlewood had left everything to Colonel Esmond, as a reparation for the wrong done to him, 'twas writ in her will. But her fortune was not much, for it never had been large, and the honest Viscountess had wisely sunk most of the money as he had upon an annuity which terminated with her life. However, there was the house and furniture, plate and pictures at Chelsea, and a sum of money lying at her merchants, Sir Josiah Child, which altogether would realize a sum of near £300 per annum, so that Mr. Esmond found himself, if not rich, at least easy for life. Likewise there were the famous diamonds which had been said to be worth fabulous sums, though the goldsmith pronounced they would fetch no more than £4,000. These diamonds, however, Colonel Esmond reserved, having a special use for them. But the Chelsea house, plate, goods, and sea, with the exception of a few articles which he kept back, were sold by his orders, and the sums resulting from the sale invested in the public security so as to realize the aforesaid annual income of £300. Having now something to leave, he made a will and dispatched it home. The army was now in presence of the enemy, and a great battle expected every day. 'Twas known that the general-in-chief was in disgrace, and the parties at home strong against him, and there was no stroke this great, and resolute player would not venture to recall his fortune when it seemed desperate. Frank Castlewood was with Colonel Esmond, his general having gladly taken the young nobleman onto his staff. His studies of fortifications at Bruxelles were over by this time. The forty was besieging had yielded, I believe, and my lord had not only marched in with flying colors, but marched out again. He used to tell his boyish wickednesses with admirable humor, and was the most charming young scapegrace in the army. 'Tis needless to say that Colonel Esmond had left every penny of his little fortune to this boy. It was the colonel's firm conviction that the next battle would put an end to him. For he felt aweary of the sun, and quite ready to bid that and the earth farewell. Frank would not listen to his comrades' gloomy forebodings, but swore they would keep his birthday at Castlewood that autumn, after the campaign. He had heard of the engagement at home. If Prince Eugene goes to London, says Frank, and Trix can get hold of him, she'll jilt Ashburnham for his highness. I tell you, she used to make eyes at the Duke of Marlborough, when she was only 14, and ogling poor little Blandford. I wouldn't marry her, Harry, no, not if her eyes were twice as big. I'll take my fun. I'll enjoy for the next 3 years every possible pleasure. I'll sow my wild oats then, and marry some quiet, steady, modest, sensible Viscountess, hunt my harriers, and settle down at Castlewood. Perhaps I'll represent the county. No, damn, you shall represent the county. You have the brains of the family. By the Lord, my dear old Harry, you have the best head and the kindest heart in all the army, and every man says so, and when the queen dies, and the king comes back, why shouldn't you go to the House of Commons, and be a minister, and be made a peer, and that sort of thing? You'll be shot in the next action. I wager a dozen of Burgundy you are not touched. Mohun is well of his wound. He is always with Corporal John now. As soon as ever I see his ugly face I'll spit in it. I took lessons of father of Captain Holt at Bruxelles. What a man that is. He knows everything. Esmond bade Frank have a care, that Father Holt's knowledge was rather dangerous. Not, indeed, knowing as yet how far the father had pushed his instructions with his young pupil. The gazetteers and writers, both of the French and English side, have given accounts sufficient of that bloody battle of Blarignies or Malplaquet, which was the last and the hardest earned of the victories of the great Duke of Marlborough. In that tremendous combat near upon 250,000 men were engaged, more than 30,000 of whom were slain or wounded. The Allies lost twice as many men as they killed of the French, whom they conquered, and this dreadful slaughter very likely took place, because a great general's credit was shaken at home, and he thought to restore it by a victory. If such were the motives which induced the Duke of Marlborough to venture that prodigious stake, and desperately sacrifice 30,000 brave lives, so that he might figure once more in a gazette, and hold his places and pensions a little longer, the event defeated the dreadful and selfish design, for the victory was purchased at a cost which no nation, greedy of glory as it may be, would willingly pay for any triumph. The gallantry of the French was as remarkable as the furious bravery of their assailants. We took a few score of their flags, and a few pieces of their artillery, But we left 20,000 of the bravest soldiers of the world round about the entrenched lines, from which the enemy was driven. He retreated in perfect good order. The panic spell seemed to be broke, under which the French had labored ever since the disaster of Hochstadt, and, fighting now on the threshold of their country, they showed an heroic ardor of resistance, such as had never met us in the course of their aggressive war. Had the battle been more successful, the conqueror might have got the price for which he waged it. As it was, and justly, I think, the party adverse to the Duke in England were indignant at the lavish extravagance of slaughter, and demanded more eagerly than ever the recall of a chief whose cupidity and desperation might urge him further still. After this bloody fight of Malplaquet, I can answer for it, that in the Dutch quarters and our own, and amongst the very regiments and commanders whose gallantry was most conspicuous upon this frightful day of carnage, the general cry was, that there was enough of the war. The French were driven back into their own boundary, and all their conquests and booty of Flanders disgorged. As for the Prince of Savoy, with whom our commander-in-chief, for reasons of his own, consorted more closely than ever, 'twas known that he was animated not merely by a political hatred, but by personal rage against the old French king. The imperial generalissimo never forgot the slight put by Louis upon the Abbe de Savoy, and in the humiliation or ruin of his most Christian majesty, the Holy Roman Emperor found his account. But what were these quarrels to us, the free citizens of England and Holland? Despot as he was, the French monarch was yet the chief of European civilization, more venerable in his age and misfortunes than at the period of his most splendid successes, whilst his opponent was but a semi-barbarous tyrant, with a pillaging, murderous horde of Croats and Pandurs, composing a half of his army, filling our camp with their strange figures, bearded like the miscreant Turks their neighbors, and carrying into Christian warfare their native heathen habits of rapine, lust, and murder. Why should the best blood in England and France be shed in order that the Holy Roman and Apostolic Master of these ruffians should have his revenge over the Christian king? And it was to this end we were fighting. For this that every village and family in England was deploring the death of beloved sons and fathers. We dared not speak to each other, even at table, of Malplaquet, so frightful were the gaps left in our army by the cannon of that bloody action. 'Twas here trending for an officer who had a heart, to look down his line on a parade day afterwards, and miss hundreds of faces of comrades humble, or of high rank that had gathered, but yesterday full of courage and cheerfulness round the torn and blackened flags. Where were our friends? As the great Duke reviewed us, riding along our lines with his fine suite of prancing aides-de-camp and generals, stopping here and there to thank an officer with those eager smiles and bows, of which his grace was always lavish, scarce a huzza could be got for him, though Cadogan, with an oath, rode up and cried, "Enu, why don't you cheer?" But the men had no heart for that. Not one of them but was thinking, "Where's my comrade? Where's my brother, that fought by me, or my dear captain that led me yesterday?" 'Twas the most gloomy pageant I ever looked on, and the E-Doom sung by our chaplains, the most woeful and dreary satire. Esmond's general added one more to the many marks of honor which he had received in the front of a score of battles, and got a wound in the groin, which laid him on his back, and you may be sure he consoled himself by abusing the commander-in-chief. As he lay groaning, "Corporal John's as fond of me," he used to say, "as King David was of General Uriah, and so he always gives me the post of danger." He persisted, to his dying day, in believing that the Duke intended he should be beat at Winendel, and sent him purposely with a small force, hoping that he might be knocked on the head there. Esmond and Frank Castle would both escape without hurt, though the division which our general commanded suffered even more than any other, having to sustain, not only the fury of the enemy's cannonade, which was very hot and well served, but the furious and repeated charges of the famous Mason Duroy, which we had to receive, and beat off again and again, with volleys of shot and hedges of iron, and our four lines of musketeers and pikemen. They said the King of England charged us no less than 12 times that day, along with the French household. Esmond's late regiment, General Webb's own fusiliers, served in the division which their colonel commanded. The general was thrice in the center of the square of the fusiliers, calling the fire at the French charges, and, after the action, His Grace the Duke of Berwick sent his compliments to his old regiment and their colonel for their Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.